Good afternoon. It's Mountain Edition. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. Aspen Mayor Steve Skadron has some choice words about President Donald Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement.
The Roaring Fork School District can celebrate both their graduating class and the increase in their graduation rates.
After several months of crowded field and two rounds of voting, the new Aspen City Council is now set.
And we speak with the author of a novel based on the true story of a South Sudanese refugee.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
First-time candidate Ward Hauenstein bested Tory by 29 votes to become Aspen's newest city council member. Allison was on hand at the city clerk's office Tuesday night as the results were announced and brings us this report.
Hauenstein and some supporters were in the room as City Clerk Linda Manning announced the final tally.
Congratulations, Ward.
Thank you.
He says the close vote doesn't signal a divided public because he and his opponent are ideologically similar.
I wouldn't put so much energy into it if I didn't think that I would do a better job, if I wouldn't be better prepared, if I wouldn't study the issues more. There are 899 people that have voted for Tory, and they're my friends. I don't think there are any bridges that have to be built, or I don't think we have to mend any fences.
Tory, who has previously served on council, was not present for the announcement. He earned 90 more votes than Hauenstein in the general election, but didn't have enough to secure a seat outright. Hauenstein will be sworn in on Monday. He says he's already working on his top priority, freeing up employee housing by offering incentives to retirees.
They have every right to be and to keep their places, but if there's some way that we can incentivize to free up bedrooms, that's every bedroom we can free up is one we don't have to build.
600 fewer people voted in the runoff election than in the general election earlier this spring.
After Ann Mullins and Ward Hauenstein's elections to the Aspen City Council, Allison spoke with producer Kristen Kay about the big decisions facing the council and what the new dynamic might bring.
It's not a diverse council in some ways as far as age, you know, longevity in Aspen. And in Aspen, when you run for city council, you don't even have to declare a political party. So that type of normal politics is not what's going to be at play with this council. Though I should mention that Ward had a strong backing from conservative Republican voter base. We'll see how beholden he feels to that. He also comes on with vocal support from sitting council members, both Adam Frisch and Bert Myron. So we'll see what if that becomes kind of a team. The thing that makes me think that won't is Myron, during the spring campaign, pointed out an extensive list of what he thought, specifically Steve and Ant, since they were rerunning, had done to let the public down. But it was pretty much an overall criticism of this council that he came on as an outsider just 2 years ago. And Ward is kind of the next generation of that. Instead of fighting council, I'll join council. So we'll have a little bit of that dynamic. Adam Frisch is maybe lining up a mayoral run. So you are going to have some conflict of kind of small picture and big picture goals as everyone sets the stage for the next coming years.
How about major issues that this council will be making the call on that are coming up?
In the next couple of weeks, they're going to have this presentation about transportation. It's coming from the Elected Officials Transportation Committee, who commissioned a study for how to solve the entrance to Aspen. What's interesting is the consultants say we should pave over Marolt, have a direct line from the roundabout to Main Street, and forget this S-curves Hallam Street stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So this new council will be between a rock and a hard place. We're like professionals who say this is better for the environment. This is better for efficiency. This is going to do a better job of keeping up with modern day transportation like bus rapid transit, like these apps that everyone's using. But then they're going to have a public who's voted that down over and over and over again. We also have the City Hall development. That's controversial for multiple reasons. Size is one of them, but Bert and Ward have both mentioned just its environmental impact. And if we're building a new building, shouldn't we make it as environmentally neutral as possible? And that's not what's in the plans right now. So you even have some people on council, not just citizens, who are complaining about the plans for a new big City Hall. And then Gorsuch and Lift 1A will come back ahead. Mm-hmm. That was a big thing this spring.
Huh, so City Council is really getting their feet wet with some controversial issues right away.
It'll be fun to watch as always.
To hear more of Allison and Kristen's conversations, including Ward and Ann's reactions to their election and their top priorities as council members, subscribe to our podcast, The Dial. To listen, go to aspenpublicradio.org and under your news tab, click on The Dial.
One of the biggest outdoor trade shows is looking for a new home, and Colorado is hoping to be selected.
The Outdoor Industry Association left Utah after 2 decades because of political differences between the Republican governor and influential outdoor brands like Patagonia. As Benta Berklin reports, a fight over public lands is bringing outdoor companies together like never before.
I call on President Trump to follow through with his promise to reverse midnight Maui executive orders. This declaration... Yeah!
That's San Juan County Commissioner Phil Lyman leading a protest in late December in Monticello, Utah, near the Bears Ears National Monument. This is where the trade show dust-up comes into play. Lyman and others, including Utah state lawmakers, members of Congress, and the governor, don't want the monument. They say it's a federal overreach and travesty of justice. And they may get their wish. The Trump administration is currently reviewing all national monuments issued within the last 2 decades.
This is a really important moment for public lands.
Hans Cole is director of environmental campaigns and advocacy for Patagonia. The clothing and outdoor gear company backs the Obama decision and has been running TV ads in a campaign called This Is Bears Ears.
For more than a century, we've fought to protect these canyons, forests, and mountains.
This is a living museum.
It's one of the most unique climbing areas.
Patagonia was also the first company to boycott the annual Outdoor Industry Association conference in Utah.
When you arrive in the airport there in Salt Lake City, you know, there's these amazing pictures of all these protected public lands on the walls. There's a real pride throughout the state of Utah in public lands. And this isn't okay that politicians are taking a stance and asking the new President Trump to rescind the monument.
I think it was initially surprising the strength that members felt.
Amy Roberts is the executive director of the Outdoor Industry Association. While many companies have long advocated for public lands, in recent months, she says the tenor and urgency has changed.
I think the fact that we started to see momentum around transferring federal public lands to the states where they would possibly be sold off and not accessible to Americans anymore, people really felt like this was an affront to what America feels about our public lands.
Most companies quickly coalesced around leaving. In states like Colorado, were more than happy to compete to win the $45 million bid. Democratic State Senator Carrie Donovan of Vail even touted a bill she had sponsored to create a first-of-its-kind public lands day that was held in May.
Very prominent and big political actions happening in the western states where the public lands are backyards, and I think that's very exciting to watch because it seems like the public lands voice is getting stronger and stronger.
Congress passed a law last year requiring the federal government to tally the industry's economic impact. Kim Miller is the North American CEO of Scarpa, which makes boots for rock climbing and backcountry skiing.
It's a big number. When you start talking about $650 billion, and that's only going to grow. So we have to figure out who we are politically.
Miller says the outdoor conference is one way to do that. And he says not everyone was behind pulling the conference out of Utah.
There are people that won't like that decision. Maybe it's because it's financially not as good for them. Or maybe they don't believe that those are the kind of issues that a trade show should pick its location based on.
So how does Colorado distinguish itself? And what would it mean to select Colorado for the industry and the movement it has accelerated?
One of the things we're going to have to focus on is how a blended economy really works.
Luis Benitez heads Colorado's Office of Outdoor Recreation Industry. He helped put the bid together to try to bring the conference here.
If the outdoor industry is becoming a little bit more politically active and a little bit more politically vocal, I think it's our responsibility to show up in a partnering kind of way and not in an exclusive our way or the highway kind of way.
A decision on the Bears Ears National Monument is expected to come soon. The Trump administration could rescind the designation or scale it back. As for Utah and Colorado, the loss and potential gain of an outdoor industry trade show is seen by those involved as a battle over public lands ownership just as much as it's about bragging rights or money. I'm Benta Berklund at the State Capitol.
Two of the Roaring Fork Valley's premier conservation organizations, the Wilderness Workshop and Aspen Valley Land Trust, are celebrating their 50th anniversaries this year. They threw a joint party in Carbondale last week, where Elizabeth Stewart Severy caught up with Michael McVoy, who has served on the boards of both organizations.
Michael, can you explain what was going on in the Roaring Fork Valley that might have inspired people to start two land conservation organizations 50 years ago?
I think what happened is the development pressures started showing up in Aspen in particular in the early 70s or late 60s, and it was clear that there was a lot of development that was going to be coming the way of this valley because of how desirable it is, that there was a need for coming up with organizations that would protect the land and try and create a value system that recognized that development wasn't necessarily the highest and best use.
What are some of the key issues that you've seen come up more recently?
I think you've seen the development pressures really concentrate in the bottom of the valley. And so one of the things that Wilderness Workshop is specifically trying to do, historically most wilderness has been above 11,000 feet. And it's become more and more important to bring the elevations down because protecting habitat and protecting the quality of the rivers and the kinds of things that wilderness helps protect is really dependent upon not just the high altitude above tree line kind of areas, but more and more bring it down closer to the valley floor to protect not only the wildlife corridors, but the scenic corridors and water quality in areas like that.
Right. Has the approach to land conservation changed in those 50 years?
Well, I think it has, and I think one of the real things, I mean, we've actually found that our efficiency has created more opposition. And just as the country has become polarized, there are more and more people who are reluctant and concerned about government ownership of property and have gotten involved in the political piece. So that's been a huge change.
So what do the next 50 years look like?
You know, I think that's going to kind of evolve, and I have found over the years that predicting the future is hazardous to accuracy. It seems to me that the important thing is to develop a diversity of levels of support, where it's a political support, it's private support, it's community support, it's organizations that support groups like the Wilderness Workshop and AVLT in their mission and help financially support those organizations. It's going to be more and more important.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you.
This is Aspen Public Radio. I'm Elizabeth Stewart Severy.
Michael McVoy has served on the boards of Wilderness Workshop and the Aspen Valley Land Trust, which are both celebrating 50 years of land conservation in the Roaring Fork Valley.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Stay in the know with what's happening in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond through our social media channels. Follow Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter. Follow us on Instagram and like us on Facebook for news updates, compelling images, and intriguing stories. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
President Trump's announcement last week that the U.S. is withdrawing from the Paris Agreement hit close to home. Elizabeth reports on the local reaction.
Aspen Mayor Steve Scadron attended the 2015 climate talks in Paris as part of the Compact of Mayors. He had some harsh words about Trump's decision.
I think it's short-sighted, irresponsible, and downright dumb.
Scadron says this reinforces the need to reduce greenhouse gas emissions at the local and state levels. He has been working to form a statewide coalition of communities. Last month, officials from 22 cities and 5 counties agreed to act aggressively on climate change. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
The Aspen Fringe Festival begins tomorrow. Arts reporter Claire Woodcock spoke with the festival's artistic director, David Lenningham, who says the recent election cycle has become the focal point.
So what are some of the issues that are coming up in this year's show?
So this year is a really unique year, and the election was just such a crazy time. And we're still in this crazy time in our country, and we're such a divided country right now. People are losing friends over the election. There's a lot going on. And so I felt like we needed to embrace that at the Fringe Festival. Not, and this is what a lot of arts organizations do is they want to take you away from that, and so that you get a vacation from, you know, dealing with all that stuff. We're different in that we want you to grapple with all those issues.
And you are narrating a show yourself.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
I wanted something that would be really more of an exploration into who we are and who we have become as a society, which reflects on the fact that we elected Donald Trump, who was not a politician, who was an actor. I mean, he's a real estate developer and an actor. So I looked around and I found this piece that Mike Daisy, and he's a comedian monologuist, and he does these long, epic monologues. He was doing this monologue during the campaign, and he stopped doing it right before the election. It's called The Trump Card. It's a very funny look into the fact that Donald Trump is our president, and how did we get there, and what were the different components in the background. You know, we look into his dad, and we look into him being an actor and his background and The Apprentice, and we look into his relationship with Roy Cohn. I mean, there's great material, and it gets better every day during Trump's presidency. So what I took was edit it, change it, update it, add to it, cut it, and basically make it their own.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming into the studio today, David.
Thank you, and we'll see you on the Fringe.
Visitors to Rudai Reservoir this summer will find new gates at the boat ramp. Officials are restricting access so they can more effectively screen for invasive mussel species. As Elizabeth reports, keeping the creatures out of the reservoir is top priority.
It's a windy afternoon in late May, the first big boating weekend of the summer. Mark Fuller stands by the gates at the Rudai Reservoir boat ramp. All vessels in and out of the water are closely inspected.
What we're looking for are boats that have been cleaned, that have been drained of water, and that are dry.
Fuller is the director of the Rudai Water and Power Authority, tasked with keeping two invasive species of mussels out of the reservoir. Zebra and quagga mussels have infested waters in nearly all of Colorado's neighboring states, and officials are concerned about people from affected areas bringing the creatures in on wet boats.
The larval form of these animals can live in any wet surface for an extremely long time, even a wet towel or a wet sponge.
For the first time, no boat is allowed on the water unless it's been inspected. Fuller has worked with seven local governments, the U.S. Forest Service, and the Ute Water Conservancy to secure triple the amount of funding of years past. This year, screenings are 7 days a week instead of five, and the lake is only open to boats when inspections are happening, from dawn till dusk. So why the concern? Well, the mussels are filter feeders, so they eat the smallest plankton, the base of the aquatic food chain. Elizabeth Brown, an expert on invasive species with Colorado Parks and Wildlife, explains.
They can filter that water and take that base of the food web out at an alarming rate, which then there's no food for the small fishies, and then there's no food for the big fishies. So it basically can impact that food web from the bottom up.
Plus, mussels use a strong, silky fiber called abyssal thread to attach themselves to pretty much any hard surface, rocks, dams, boats, flip-flops. Fuller says officials from CPW brought in a sandal that had been dropped in an infested lake.
It was just like this shoe-shaped mass of shell of these creatures who had not only glommed onto the flip-flop, but then had glommed onto each other. It's really scary.
When the mussels attach to other hard surfaces, like the inner workings of a dam, it can be even more frightening. Fuller says an infestation at Rudai could mean constant maintenance to keep vital parts of the dam working and the right amount of water flowing out of the reservoir. Once these mussels get into a body of water, there's no getting them out. So far, Colorado's inspection system has been successful in preventing the spread of these mussels, but other popular spots have not been so lucky. Mark Anderson is an aquatic ecologist for the National Park Service.
We watched over from 2013 up to 2016 as their population expanded and moved across Lake Powell.
That's over 200 miles in 3 years. In trying to prevent Lake Powell from being infested, the Park Service spent over $1 million annually. But staff still couldn't keep up with the 400,000 boat launches on the lake every year.
Yeah, the whole way through our prevention program, we always felt like we were just probably just barely a step ahead of it. And I think we just weren't able to move quite fast enough, ultimately.
As officials at Lake Powell keep an extra eye on infrastructure there, they're also working to contain the mussels and help prevent infestations elsewhere. From Lake Powell to Rudai and at reservoirs across the West, the mantra is clean, drain, and dry. It's a way of educating boaters about their role in stopping the spread of invasive species, even as state funding for inspections dries up. Colorado Parks and Wildlife lost about $4 million in funding in 2016, and boaters might feel the consequences. Harvey Gap Reservoir near Rifle is no longer allowing motorized boats. NCPW programs that monitor other aquatic species have been cut to direct more attention to this most pressing concern. Brown says these mussels are the most environmentally devastating and economically challenging species in the country. It's going to take creative partnerships to keep the inspections going.
You know, if we can all just keep working together, boaters and industry and governments together, we can stay ahead of this issue and protect fishing and boating and infrastructure for water in Colorado.
And that's what's happening at Rudai, where 9 different entities are keeping the mussels at bay. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Wyatt Orm. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While you're browsing our site, make sure to sign up for ForkFed, our weekly digital newsletter. ForkFed arrives in your inbox every Friday, catching you up on the week's news in a fun and informative way.
Last weekend, the Roaring Fork School District held its graduation ceremonies. Some schools saw dramatic increases in graduating seniors.
Bridges High School just graduated more seniors than ever. It's the alternative school in Carbondale. On Friday, 54 of the 64 seniors graduated. This group also earned double the number of scholarships than the previous year. Roaring Fork High School in Carbondale graduated 83. Basalt High School graduated 73 seniors. 90% of them are going on to pursue 2 or 4 year degrees. This is 20% more than did last year. Glenwood Springs High School graduated 188 seniors out of a class of 192.
The Colorado Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday about the city of Aspen's fee on disposable grocery bags. Elizabeth reports.
The case deals with a city ordinance that requires shoppers to pay 20 cents to use paper bags supplied by local grocery stores. The nonprofit group Colorado Union of Taxpayers contends that the fee is actually a tax, and under Colorado's Taxpayers Bill of Rights, or Tabor laws, should have gone to a vote. Aspen Assistant City Attorney Andrea Bryan defended the charge. She says because it's not intended to generate revenue for the city, it is not a tax.
Aspen's paper bag fee under this court's precedent has all of the characteristics of a Tabor-exempt fee.
Brian says the funds collected are used for specific waste reduction services. Both the Colorado Court of Appeals and a 9th Judicial District judge previously agreed with the city of Aspen. The state's highest court does not have a set time frame to make a ruling. Elizabeth Stewart Severy, Aspen Public Radio Environment Desk.
Holy Cross Energy is one of the electric utilities that serves much of the Roaring Fork Valley. They just hired a new CEO, and new board members are being elected. This election has gained some attention, maybe more than you'd expect for a public utility. Wyatt joined Kristen in the studio to talk about why.
So how many seats on the board of directors are open?
2 seats are open. One is for the Northern District, and the Northern District starts east of Glenwood Canyon and goes over towards Vail. And the other is for the Western District, which starts in Marble and goes down to Glenwood Springs and then over to Parachute. And there are 5 candidates for the Western District's board seat.
Okay, so an election for the board of a public utility. Why should we care? Is this a big deal?
Some say that it is. Auden Schindler, who is the vice president of sustainability at the ski company, wrote an op-ed in the Aspen Times endorsing David Hornbacher. And Dan Richardson, who's the mayor of Carbondale, wrote a similar endorsement for Hornbacher in the Vail Daily.
What did they tell you about why they wrote the letters?
I spoke with both. They basically said, this is an opportunity to affect change on a large scale. Dan Richardson, for instance, told me that of any organization in the Valley, Holy Cross is in the best position to affect regional emissions. Holy Cross has made some steps towards renewable energy use, but they still get more than half of their electricity from coal, and both Richardson and Schindler are interested in changing that.
How much power does this position carry? Can this board member really affect much change?
The board does seem to be very involved. Schindler basically told me that this is kind of an opportunity to get a board that's all leaning in the same direction. This has made some community members wary. A man named Tom Turnbull wrote a letter to the editor published in the Aspen Times where he basically said, "We want balance within the board of directors. We don't want them to all think the same way." And so he endorsed someone else, a man named Jared Kirst.
How many people usually vote in this type of election?
Holy Cross is a co-op, so all the members vote for the board, and there are 43,000 members, so the utility sent out 43,000 ballots. As long as you're a member, you can vote. So you can live in Vail and still vote for one of the five candidates vying for the Western District seat. In contested elections like this one, the utility told me they receive typically 4,000 or so ballots back, meaning less than 10% of eligible voters actually vote.
The deadline to vote in the Holy Cross Energy Board election is today, June 8th.
Harriet Levin Milan's first book, How Fast Can You Run, is based on the true story of a South Sudanese refugee. She spoke earlier this week at Explore Booksellers. Clara sat down with her to talk about where the story originated.
Milan's debut novel is based on the story of Michael Majo Kuch, a boy featured in the PBS documentary Lost Boys of Sudan. Milan says the two decided to call the book How Fast Can You Run so readers could put themselves in Kuch's or other refugees' shoes. Because being affected by war doesn't only happen to the other.
The history of humanity is really a refugee narrative, and the perpetrators may vary, but these stories have been repeated since Adam and Eve.
It starts when Kuch was 5 years old.
His village was torched, and he was forced to run for his life. He ran into a forest, and he hid in a tree for 2 days. He was found by a child soldier, and this child soldier said that if he followed him, Michael would find his parents, who he had been separated from.
He did not find his parents there. Instead, the child soldier led him into an Ethiopian training camp. When he was deemed too short for the army and war broke out, Kuch was forced to walk again, through desert and forest, without food and protection.
He joined up with thousands of other so-called lost boys, then eventually wound up in Kenya, where he lived for about 10 years. That was a real refugee camp, as opposed to a training camp.
Milan, a creative writing professor at Drexel University, first met Kuch in Pennsylvania. Together, the pair worked for 2 years to transform his true story into a work of historical fiction. Milan says the collaboration was a difficult line to walk.
He would tell me something that happened to him, and I would go back and I would create scenes. And then I would show it to him. And he would say, "That's not the way it happened. You have to put this in." But eventually I would try to do it in a way that was satisfying for both of us.
As she travels to promote her book, she reminds readers of Aspen that a person doesn't get to choose where they're born. She calls this a great injustice of life, which is what makes these refugees' stories significant. Claire Woodcock, Edless Neeson Arts and Culture Desk.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Wyatt Orm.
And I'm Allison Bechtesh. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News. Are you ready? Allison, stop laughing.